The Washington News Bureau of the American Broadcasting Company presents From the Capitol, a public affairs program from the nation's capital. This is William McIntyre of the ABC Washington News staff. My guest is the Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, George P. Larrett. The FDA, as it's called, is set up to protect the consumer from harmful food and drugs. It has a staff of 2,500, including nearly 700 field investigators. Most of the FDA's regulations have gone unchanged for nearly a quarter of a century. Recent shocking revelations, involving especially the drug thalidomide, have led to pressure for title rules over the marketing of new drugs, changes that can be made by the stroke of a pen. In addition, President Kennedy over the weekend renewed his call for stricter laws to make sure drugs are both safe and effective. Mr. Larrick, it's a pleasure to have you with us on From the Capitol. The American people, sir, have become deeply concerned in recent days about the sedative thalidomide, which when taken by pregnant women can cause their babies to be born hideously deformed. But with the action that's been taken so far, Mr. Larrick, by the Food and Drug Administration, can we be fairly sure that there's nothing more to worry about?
I think that you can be fairly sure that there's nothing further to worry about. Have all the doctors who were supplied the drug for test purposes returned or destroyed?
The visits that we have made to the four firms who were subsidiaries of one firm that distributed this drug sent it to a total of 1,231 physicians. Of this number, our inspectors have visited 1,073. They found that 158 doctors were not immediately available for one reason or another. Many are on vacation. Some are traveling in Europe. A few have died. But we have seen all of the doctors that received the drug except 158. And of the doctors whom we interviewed, we found that 67 still had a supply of the drug on hand.
And what are they going to do with that supply?
And while they were not using the drug, they either destroyed the article while our inspector or an inspector from a state or city health department was there, or they gave the drug to these officials.
I see. What about the doctors you haven't seen yet? Are you fairly sure that they haven't indiscriminately prescribed the drug to pregnant women?
Well, I would think that the pattern that we've found to date would be likely to be followed in the case of the 158 doctors that we haven't seen. But quite naturally, I can't say with certainty what we'll find when we interview these additional doctors. But the picture to date has been quite reassuring.
Given the evidence you have so far, how many pregnant women in this country took thalidomide tablets that were administered by U.S. doctors?
There were a number of women in the latter stages of pregnancy to whom the drug was administered as a sedative. Fortunately, at that stage of pregnancy, the buds, so-called, that later grow into the arms and legs have formed. And these mothers, fortunately, gave birth to normal children.
What are the odds, Mr. Larrick, on bearing a deformed child if thalidomide is taken in the early stages of pregnancy?
I don't think anyone can give a really authoritative answer to that question. I don't think we have enough information yet. But I have talked to some physicians who are perhaps as well informed as any about it, and particularly to our own Dr. Kelsey, of whom we're very proud. And the informed guess is that the chance of having a deformed child even if the drug was taken during the critical period, is not greater than 50%.
50%. That's one out of two.
Yes, and that is really a guess rather than an estimate.
Mm-hmm. Just looking back a little bit, what was the time factor on this this cruel drug? The lag between first indications it had hazardous side effects and its actual banishment.
Well, the drug was first marketed in Germany way back in 1959, and it's in some parts of Europe at least. It was so highly regarded as a safe drug that it was permitted to be sold even without a prescription. I believe that our Dr. Kelsey and her associates learned about the possibility of an adverse effect upon the nerves when she read a medical journal from England, which came out in February of 61. And this suggested the possibility that the drug might, in occasional instance, cause a condition known as peripheral nephritis. Painful, but not a fatal disease. And that, I believe, particularly aroused her concern about maybe what it might do to the fetus. It wasn't till late November 1961 that reports came in from Germany, which strongly suggested the possible causal relationship between the consumption of this drug and the birth of babies without arms and legs. And the lag from then on was not great.
Well, how many months elapsed after November before the American company, which handled a test distribution of the drug, told the doctors who were testing it to cease?
Well, the chronology is that late in November, they and we learned that there was a possibility of a relationship between this bad effect and the drug. And they communicated this to us, and on December 4, they addressed a letter to all of their clinical investigators involved and told them that there was a suspicion of a relationship between these deformities and the drug, and directed that no more of the drug be used in the case of women in the premenopausal age. In other words, in women in the age where they could conceivably be affected. And by March, further evidence and information had been acquired, and at that time, a letter issued calling for complete stoppage of the use of the drug as an experimental drug.
In other words, about 4 months elapsed from the time you had considerable evidence from abroad of the very dangerous effect of this and when it was ordered. Isn't this quite a long time span? Looking back, could it have been shorter? Do you have the power to make it
shorter? Certainly, the shorter it would be, the better it would
right.
be. But the certainly under the statute, with no positive proof that if there was a relationship, I don't know what more could have been done, particularly since on December 4, they did send out a letter directing the stoppage of the drug for use by women who might be susceptible to it.
Well, that leads us into this question of the existing regulations. In your view, are the biggest loopholes at the present time that prevent you from doing the kind of job you'd ideally like to do?
Well, you have to divide the problem into two phases. One is the phase during which a drug is under investigation for possible addition to the doctor's supply of drugs that he can use to alleviate human suffering. And the second phase is the distribution and sale of the drug commercially.
In the first phase, what are the major loopholes? Involving new drugs like thalidomide.
We're in the process now of making a careful study of how our regulations can be tightened up to provide maximum protection of the public and at the same time, without putting artificial barriers, unnecessary barriers, in the progress of the development of life-saving drugs. The president, in his most recent press conference, stated that he was asking the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare to study this problem. And I was directed immediately by our secretary to present to him proposals of new regulations. That has been done. And the proposals that we have made are now under study by a staff in the department, whom I am sure can constructively add to our suggestions. And I anticipate that at an early date, a decision will be made as to what changes in these regulations are appropriate.
Well, now, carrying this a little further and a little more specifically, do you think there's a need for federal rules governing the actual administration of an unlicensed drug to a patient?
Well, the statute now provides that only in the terms of the law, experts qualified by scientific training and experience to evaluate the safety of drugs are permitted to administer such drugs to people. I think that a clearer definition of just what the law means in that connection will be helpful.
You mean right now the expert need not be a physician?
No, I would say that in the United States to administer drugs to people, not only under this statute, but more particularly under your state medical licensure acts, that the person who administers a drug to a person has to have a license to do so.
But right now, this is all up to the drug companies in terms of the procedure followed in testing a particular new drug.
The statute places a criminal liability on the manufacturer who distributes drugs to live up to that principle. I should point out that in considering the desirability of tightening our regulations, that bear in mind that this drug did not get on the market, and the law, and the, particularly the doctors and other scientists in the FDA, did keep the drug off the market. So the need for change isn't as great as it would be if we had had a calamity in this country.
Must a doctor at the present time tell his patient he's being administered an unlicensed drug?
The practice of the physician with relation to his own patient is left to the ethics of the physician and perhaps in some instances to the state law. I personally do not believe that the Food and Drug Administration should inject itself into the relationship between an individual doctor and his individual patient.
Is there any government control at the present time over the testing of a new drug on animals before it's tested on people? Or some have suggested that we are the real guinea pigs. That's what.
The practice is first to go very far into the chemistry of the drug by a complete knowledge of the chemistry, knowledge of the structural formula, for example. Scientists can make certain forecasts as to the likely effects of the drug. In other words, if you have a structural formula for aspirin and you devise another drug that has a formula very similar to aspirin, competent people can forecast that this drug, too, will be likely to allay pain. So the first thing is to work out the chemistry very carefully. The next step is to turn to animals, and usually turn to at least two species of animals, because animals differ from one species to another. And to administer the drug, usually in varying amounts to different groups of animals, and in amounts many times greater on a body weight basis than you would ever administer to people. Then to carefully study those animals, to study their blood, their heart, their brain, and all of their organs, and try to get as close a knowledge and as great a knowledge of just what effect this drug had on those animals as you can. And only after that has been completed and evaluated by the best minds in this business do you turn to the human clinic. And then you go to the top flight people, the folks in the hospitals and in the medical schools and the great medical institutions who have at their command staffs, broad knowledge, all medical facilities of X-ray, laboratory facilities and whatnot, and you begin very cautiously to administer these drugs. And you move on as you get more information. And that's how 90% of the drugs that the doctor prescribes today that were not known of when most doctors graduated from medical schools, if they graduated more than 15 years ago, were born. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that many people are alive today who would not be alive if that process had not been followed.
Well, you are then, from what you've just said, satisfied with the current link between testing on animals and testing on people, so far as the authority of your...
No, I'm not satisfied.
What improvements do you think might help?
I think that in this whole field of developing technology, in the field of the chemicals that we must use today to grow our agricultural products, in the chemicals that we add to our food supplies so that we may have convenient foods, and in the matter of developing drugs increasingly to prolong life and alleviate human suffering, that we need to improve all phases of the regulation of it systematically as new discoveries are made. And I think now that we should take full advantage of this episode and make changes that will make it unlikely that another episode of this sort might occur, or even that it might get by our testing and control procedures and get on the market.
These tighter regulations now in the works, what is their chief thrust?
The chief thrust would be to try to discover every possible loophole which might make it possible for a drug to unnecessarily injure a human being.
Doesn't the fact that in the case of thalidomide, we have had no reported cases of malformed births due to the U.S. distribution program suggest that the current setup is rather adequate?
It suggests that the current setup worked on this drug, and we're very proud of that fact. I think important in this whole picture is the legislation that the president has sent forward to the Congress, or the recommendations that he has made, which would tighten up the whole business of drug control in this country. And in that, among that legislation are some proposals that would be highly protective of the American people in this area and in others.
These deal, to a rather great extent, don't they, with the licensed drug, the drug after it is on the market?
Yes, it deals very much so with the drug after it has passed through our new drug licensing, as you call it, procedure.
Whereas in the case of thalidomide, we're talking about new drugs.
Before they go through that procedure.
Uh, Can you make most of the improvements that you'd like to see made administratively when it comes to these new unlicensed drugs?
That is one problem. It's under study, but I am advised by counsel, and my own opinion is that we can. Insofar as the drug is concerned, before it's put on the market commercially, I think we need very much to have strengthened laws to deal with the drug after it's put on the market commercially.
Why is it that all of a sudden now the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare announces tighter regulations are in the works? Why not a year ago? Why not a month ago? Was it just thalidomide that prompted this? It's been a quarter of a century
speak for the secretary or anyone else, but the Food and Drug Administration has had under consideration for a long time proposed revision of these regulations. And so far as we're concerned, certainly this episode accelerated our concern and made it so that the public attention and interest accelerated our proposal of the new regulations.
Just briefly on a couple of other, I think, very interesting and important areas, Mr. Larrick. In the light of some recent articles which indicate the overuse of pesticides is harmful to wildlife, do you think any line should be drawn regarding the extent to which the public should continue to use these pesticides, these bug killers?
Yes, I think you have, in the use of pesticides, a very real problem. I don't think that we could have in this country today the abundant, diversified food supply that we have if we did not have the pesticides. So we need them. But in the case of each one of them, the Department of Agriculture, working with the Food and Drug Administration, lay down very precise rules about how it should be used, and we lay down a rule about how much of the pesticide dare be left on the fruit or the vegetable or what have you. I think it is imperative that precautionary steps be observed so that the person who eats the finished product will not get more of the pesticide than our tolerances permit. And while it's not my business officially, I also am concerned as a citizen that the pesticides be used so that it does not harm our wildlife.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Larrick. Our time is up. Thank you for being our guest today on From the Capitol. This is William McIntyre, ABC, Washington.